I live in their own world. Folks, this is Frank V. Right here. Frank V. What is the V for? Valley. He's going to give us a great talk. I'm going to go sit down and quit doing this.
I'm shorter than he is, so I've got to lower this down. Well, I'm kind of honored to be here, so I'll do the best I can with my speaking. You know, if somebody would have told me 35 years ago that I was going to be speaking here at the Oktoberfest, I would have told them, you're full of you-know-what. Because I was the type of guy that loved to drink, and I loved the lifestyle, and I loved the not being responsible for anything, you know. And today I'm very grateful to be sober, and I'm very I love to pass the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, it did save my life. You know, it literally saved my life. And so when I get a chance to talk about my life, I hardly ever refuse it, you know, because I really believe in the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to help another alcoholic, you know. And I know a lot of us in here, we're all sober, you know. But in my talk, I hope that I can say something that might help somebody, you know, remain sober. And if you're having, you know, doubts about if you're an alcoholic or not, you know, because I did, I had all those doubts that, you know, maybe I'm not alcoholic, maybe I could still drink one, you know. And but what I like about talking, Alcoholics Anonymous format makes it easy, because, you know, it's how, you know, how it was. And I want to talk about how it was now, and, you know, what happened and how it is now, you know. And that's that makes it easy for me to remember my life with the journey of my drinking, you know. You know, I was introduced to alcohol at a really young age, because I came from a migrant family, and I remember as a kid in the camps, you know, my family members, well, they always drank, you know, there was always alcohol around, you know. And so, and I remember as I grew up in that environment, my cousins, you know, they were maybe a little 10 years older or so, and they would drink, you know, and they would say, yeah, here, take a drink, become a man, you know. So that kind of made, you know, alcohol kind of acceptable to drink. And I never heard anybody say, oh, if you drink, you're going to become an alcoholic. Oh, if you drink, you're going to get drunk, you know. But it was just kind of an acceptable thing in our culture of the Hispanic and living in the ranches and traveling and, you know, camping out here and there, you know. But eventually, you know, my dad, he got a job in town. So I'm originally from Lemoore, California, but I live in Visalia. I've lived in Visalia the last 25 years, you know. But I've been coming to meetings here the last 10 years, because when I married a lady that lived here in Visalia after my first divorce, and so I moved to Visalia, and I didn't come to very many meetings. But once she passed on, and I started meeting the meetings again, you know. But back to my drinking, you know, the acceptance of the drinking, you know, in the family. And then when I moved to town, well, I lived in the neighborhood that there was, everybody drank. You know, it was pretty much a drinking neighborhood. There was about four blocks of, you know, all Hispanic people in every house you went to. You know, everybody was drinking. you know. But we had a place, we had one house where all of us guys, about the age of 13, and I think I started drinking with my peers. We all get together like Friday evening or Saturday evening, and then at that age, we didn't drink every weekend, but if we had a special occasion like, you know, the rock and roll dance, we would go, we would, you know, get our beer and stuff. Hey, let's go, let's get some gas in the car and let's go. You know, and that's how that habit became a regular habit, where we would drink in for everything that we did, and then of course that made us braver, that made us better looking, and you know, give us a lot of courage to ask the girls to dance and all that stuff. It was really good stuff then, you know, and so that's how I became. That was my, that journey of drinking was, that's what I did, you know. And I had to have a drink. It just seemed like even at that age, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, let's get some beer. I mean, everybody get a dollar or buy a case, you know, or a couple of cases, you know. And then, you know, it went that way through high school, you know. And I was an athlete, you know, and I drank, you know, I was a quarterback, and I drank for three, I was a quarterback for 3 years, and I drank, you know, after just about every after game, we would go out in the country. And that was kind of what we did, the groups, you know. And it just wasn't just the Hispanic, it was everybody, the football team, you know. We'd all get some beer and we'd go out and turn the radio on, flip the door open, and we would go out there and dance. That was the happy days, they call it, in the 50s, you know. And so that's what, and that was our fun. You know, but there was always alcohol involved, always alcohol involved. You know, so that I went through that stage. You know, then I went to college. You know, I went to college to play basketball. Then it was party just about every night at the college. Party, 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 party. You know, so I almost flunked out, and I gave up the basketball team, and then I moved to San Jose, and because there was a friend of mine that was going in, that was working in San Jose, and I quit going to school. She says, "Well, I'm doing construction, and I can get you a job out here, you know." So I did, and so I went to San Jose for, I'd say, 4 years, and that was in the early 60s. And of course, partying all the time. It was drinking. We drank quite a bit. San Jose State. That's where I was. I lived in that area, where our apartment was in the San Jose State area. You could walk across the street and you were there. And then just about, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there was partying. You know, all the college kids. Well, that was down my line, you know. Hell, I like to drink, I like to party, you know, why not? You know, but I was working in construction. And even the construction guys, when we got off of work, there was a little bar by our shop, you know. And so we'd go drink after we get home from work. So it just seemed like it was nothing but drinking, you know. Of course, I enjoyed it. I could handle my drinking at that time. I could handle it, you know. I'd get drunk, but I'd get up and go to work the next day, you know. So I was about early 20s, about 20, 21, you know. And about that time, I began to realize that, you know, why am I drinking so much? You know, I mean, there's got to be more to life than this. Even at that stage of my life, I felt that there was something wrong about my drinking, you know. So I said, well, maybe if I get married, this will stop and slow me down, you know. So, you know, what happened, I did meet my first wife. I went back to my hometown and I met my first wife. And I had known her from the past. And so one thing led to another, just to make cut it short, is that I ended up marrying her, and I moved to San Jose for a while. Construction got slow, and then I went back to Lemoore. I came back to Lemoore, you know. And but back in Lemoore, it was more drinking, you know, my hometown, you know, more drinking. And then I was of age to go to the bars, you know. And Bo and I were talking earlier, and I remember seeing him here, there, because Bo was in the Navy, you know. So at that, in 62, 63, 64, the Navy just came into Lemoore. And so I was, you know, I ran into a lot of Navy guys in there. As a matter of fact, I fought a few of them. But because the craziness started to creep in. You know, I used to drink in the bars all the time, even at that age. And then, I thought maybe the marriage was going to say, okay, I married a woman with two kids, okay, a ready-made family. And then I had two of my own right away, so I was 23 years old. I already had four kids, you know. And so, you know, I'm saying, well, it's not slowing me down, you know. And I kept drinking, you know. And I was getting, you know, I was getting drunk, you know, and I knew I drank in blackouts, you know. And I was drinking more than I really wanted to. And all those symptoms of addiction that come about and you really sneak up on you, you know, you don't want to drink because you know you might get drunk, but then you just go ahead and do it. And then before you know it, you're drunk, you know. And then you're taking a chance on your DUI and all that. I hadn't had any DUIs at that time, you know. So I kept thinking, you know, something wrong here. But in those days, no AA. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody told me, hey, you're drinking too much. You know, you can't control your drinking. There was times, yeah, when I got drunk and made an ass of myself, and then my dad or my mom would say, well, you know what you did last night? I says, no, what? Nah, I don't want to hear about it, you know. I'm just going to go get a beer and forget about it, you know. So, you know, it's making those excuses and the denial factors were starting to set in, you know. And I should have, what I know about alcoholism today, you know, those were direct symptoms of alcoholism, you know. But I didn't know anything, you know. All I knew was how to put that bottle to my mouth and drink it and get drunk. And I was one of these guys that, if I took that first drink, that wasn't the only one I was going to have. I was going to have as much as I could until I got drunk or even passed out. But as time went on, at that time I wasn't having any marriage problems, you know. I kept promising my ex-wife that, oh yeah, I'm going to have to slow down, I got to quit, you know. Or even then, you know, I was already thinking about quitting. So I got laid off of this one job, and then this friend of mine from Venice called me and he said, hey, why don't you come up here and work over here in L.A., you know, in Venice, California, at the beach. I said, yeah, okay, I'll go up there. And he sent me some money. He's my college buddy, and we drank together. You know, it's a guy that I met in college, and we became really good friends. And he went in the Air Force and then got out, and then he was working for the aircraft companies up there, and he wanted me to come down there with him, you know. So he sent me $30, you know. So I get the $30 in the mail, just to mention this, because this is how, you know, what happens when you already have a problem and don't know it, you know. So I get the Saugus and my car breaks down, and I says, how the hell am I going to get to Venice now? This thing won't even run. And I remember I had a cousin in Saugus. So I called him up, and he came to pick me up. And my cousin Frank, just like me, heavy drinker, just like me. I stayed there for 4 days at his house and didn't tell nobody where I was at. My dad was calling everywhere. My buddy was calling my house in Lemoore. And he said, "Where's Frank? Where's Frank?" You know, which me. They finally figured it out, and they called my cousin Frank and said, "Oh yeah, he's over here. He's been here 4 days, you know." So I finally got to Venice, and my buddy, he was pissed, man. He was just, "What? At least you could have done it was called." I said, "Oh, you know what? I was having so much fun. I didn't think about it, you know." Which was, that was not true, you know. I had to lie to them because my car wasn't running, yeah. But I could have called them and said, "Hey," his name was Dave. He says, "Hey, Dave, I got my car broke down. I'll be over here a couple of days." But I didn't. The irresponsibility of me was starting to set in. Okay, so I moved. I worked. I got a job right away. I was an auto body and fender man. And I got there on a Tuesday, and a Thursday I had a job. So I worked there in Venice for 6 years. So I spent 6 years there. And my drinking got heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier. And I was about 27. And then I had a little domestic violence episode with my first wife, and I promised her. I says, "Okay, yeah, I'm going to do it this time." I says, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to quit. I'm going to look for an AA meeting. Then I had heard that there was AA meetings in Santa Monica. So I looked in the newspaper, and I said, "Yeah, there's one right there. I'm going to that tonight." So I get in my car, and I head out to that address. By then, I have the knowledge of the area around pretty well. And so I go to that address, and I can't find it. I see the numbers, you know. And I'm looking at the numbers, and I didn't see. I didn't know what to look for, really. You know, usually there's a sign that says AA wherever you go. But I was looking right at a bar right below, and then it must have been on the top floor. So I walked in the bar and got drunk and went home. And then I lied to her. "Yeah, I went to a meeting, you know. But here's the address." And there it is right there. So that's the only time there that I went looking for an AA meeting, you know, in Santa Monica. And so I decided, I got to get out of this town. I'm drinking too much. So I says, "Let's just go back to Lemoore, which is my hometown. I was born and raised there, you know." So just before we left, I got my first DUI. I was out drinking, and I hit a car, and of course I went to jail and all that. And, excuse me, get some water. So back in them days, I got my first DUI. I got a lawyer, and he says, and I told him, "Why don't you handle this for me? I got the money, and I won't be here. I'm moving out of town." And he did. You know, I just called him one day, and I said, "Did you handle all that?" "Oh yeah, never mind. You just got a first DUI." Then I didn't have to go to drunk driving school or anything. Just pay the fine. You know, so I ended up, you know, and okay there. So I, before I went to my hometown, I went to Santa Cruz because these people that moved me to Santa Cruz. And then I moved back to Lemoore. Okay. So now I'm in Lemoore. And now I'm really drinking because all my buddies are there, you know, the guys I grew up with, you know. So that was, I was about 27, 28 years old about that time. And that's about the time that I drank, and Bo used to drink at that bar, Jay and I, Smokies. And I remember seeing him there, but we don't remember each other, but I remember seeing him there, you know. But So I drank pretty heavy every day. Every day. So from 28 to 38, I got 6 DUIs in my hometown, just to make it short, you know. And about that time, my first wife was pretty much fed up, and she was drinking. Now, she took over, she went to drinking, you know. So we would be in the same bars, but we wouldn't be together. You know, and so we were drinking, and she was over there, and I was over here, and it was a mess. You know, it was really a family mess. It was really dysfunctional. You know, but we'd always end up at the same house. You know, and finally, when I got my 6th DUI, the DA, they all knew me. All the lawyers knew me. All the judges knew me, because it was such every 18 months I was in and out of court, and then I was on probation. I bet you I was on probation for 10 years at that point in time in my life. You know, and I always got the same probation officer. You know, so when I went in for the 6th DUI, he said, "Frank," he says, "look at all this. Look, he had a stack of papers like this in his desk." He says, "all this under drinking." You know, and then how could I not know that, you know? But I did, you know, but I just couldn't stop drinking, you know. And I know that there was times when I got my 6th DUI, I used to agonize about how am I going to quit drinking, you know. I mean, nobody knows how to quit. Nobody knows how to tell me how to quit drinking, you know. So I remember one time I was on a Sunday. I had been drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and there was a church sermon on television, and one of the reverends says, "Anybody got a problem of any kind, addiction or whatever?" And I said, "Catch the television," you know. So I went over there and heard that damn television. I remember that because I wanted to quit, but I didn't know how. You know, I was agonizing all this time towards the last, you know. And then when I got my 6th DUI, I said, you know, I'm up shit hill without a paddle, you know. And luckily, what happened was that when I was my probation officer says, "they want to put you 2 years in prison." He says, "but I'm going to suggest one thing." He's closed the door. He says, "look," he says, "Frank," he already knew me by my first name. He didn't call me by Mr., you know. He said, "Frank," he says, "I'm an alcoholic," he says. "I go to meetings, not around here." He says, "you need to get your butt in the inpatient program today or tomorrow or whenever." He says, "there's a new one opening up in Hanford." He says, "yeah." So I had two friends that were working for the county. One was the Superior Court judge, and one was head of the welfare. And they got together with the DA, and they said, "you can't put this guy in jail." He says, "this guy's a real good guy. We went to school with him, you know. He's got a drinking problem, you know." But the DA, he wouldn't agree with that, you know. So, but I did get into the inpatient program, but I hadn't been sentenced yet. So while I was in there for about a month, my counselor would say, "okay, Mr. Valley." She would call me Mr. Valley because she didn't like me very well in the beginning, and I didn't like her, you know. Because number one, she was a woman and she was telling me what to do. That's the alcohol in my, you know. And then I was having problems with my marriage but that's how it started. That's how my behavior in the inpatient program was. So she would say, get your suitcase, and we had to go to the court to find out what was going to happen to me. So we would go. And then the judge would look at me. Of course, you know, I had gone to high school with him, you know, and we were both athletes from Limo High School, and his mother was my teacher in the seventh grade, so he knew me well, you know. He knew who I was, and I used to talk to him outside when he was a new judge. And my friend Bill was there, but, I mean, he wasn't in the courthouse, but he was taking, finding out what was going on. But anyway, I went about three times, and then the last time was the judge, his name is Tim, was his first name, Tim. He says, he did call me Mr. Valley. He says, Mr. Valley. I said, oh, shit, I'm going to get it this time. He's going to set my ass up. He says, I'm going to prison. He says, he went like this. He says, I have never done this ever since he'd been the Superior Court judge for about 20 years already. He says, I'm going to give you one chance. He says, I'm going to let you stay on the inpatient program. Oh, man, you should have, my heart was just pounding there, and it just kind of slowed up after he told me that, because, you know, I was already feeling better about myself being sober. You know, because I had already been there a month, and I hadn't drank, and I says, oh, man, I think I could probably like it in here, you know. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because that kind of was a beginning of my decision to quit drinking, because now I knew that I could stay sober in here, but I didn't know about outside, you know. But the feeling of the self-confidence that there is such a thing of not putting alcohol in your body, okay? And so, and that's how it started with my moments of wanting to stay sober. And then when we used to go to meetings, almost every night we went to an AA meeting, you know. And those guys were giving me the strength, you know, and the hope. Yes, to stay sober, because I had seen some of those, I drank with some of those guys in AA, and they used to tell me, yeah, you can stay sober, hell, we're staying sober in AA, you know. So there's another avenue that I was starting to discover, and say, these guys are staying sober, hell, I can too, you know. And so while I was in there for 7 months, I read the book twice. I read a book twice. I wanted to find out, well, you know, what is this program? You know, and then I read it, and there, of course, it's all good stuff. I was taking everything in, you know, and I was beginning to realize that this might be a program for me, you know. And so as time went on, I became more confident that I was going to stay sober. I became more confident, you know. And then me and my counselor, you know, we kind of, you know, cool things down, you know. And we begin to like each other, as, you know, as people, as individuals, you know. And so it was that made it easier for me to be in the inpatient program, you know, because I wasn't clashing with her, you know. I wasn't clashing with her, you know. And like we did in the beginning, you know. Because the reason why we clashed is because she says, you know, the first time you go into that house, they put you in the middle, and she asked me, Mr. Valley, why are you here? And I says, well, I don't know. I got a little trouble with the law. She says, you're here because you're an alcoholic. And that pissed me off right away. But she was right. You know, as time went on, I realized she was right, you know. And so that kind of cooled me off, you know. But anyway, just to mention that, that's what happened there in the inpatient program. And so I got a chance to read the book twice. I got a chance to go to a lot of meetings. I got a chance to see people were getting sober. People were staying sober. So Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to hear and understand what one day at a time was, you know, or is. And I got a chance to hear some of the cliches that they were saying, like, keep it simple, stupid, you know, let go, let God. And, you know, those AA slogans that I had never heard before. You know, and then I wondered what they were, you know, and then time went on, I began to understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and that was what was good about being in there for me, is it sat me down, and I was able to concentrate on me, you know. And a few things happened in there. You know, my wife, ex-wife, she gave me my divorce papers in there. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because had I not been in there, I probably went out and got drunk. Because that's all I knew how to do, is how to combat these emotional upsets, you know. And so... I got over it real quick, you know. And then, you know, I realized, well, you know what, you know, I've done a lot of stuff to her, and, you know, I was never a real good husband, never a real good father. And I began to, my inventory on that situation, you know. And yeah, I could see where it was all my fault, you know. Yeah, I went to one meeting towards the end of my stay at the inpatient program, and they were talking about the eighth step and the ninth step. And it hit me right in the face. I says, yeah, you know what? That's me. I need to apologize to her. Then I had telephone privileges. So the first thing I did after the meeting the next day, because I thought about it at night, you know. Yeah, I said, I'm pretty much the jerk that caused this breakup of our marriage, you know. So I called her up. I says, you know, I want you to forgive me. I says, you know, I forgive you for whatever you did. Because she did mess around with others and me too, you know. But I says, I want you to forgive me. And I'm going to stay sober from now on. And I think a little bit of I felt like maybe we was going to get back together again. You know, I don't know why I had that thought, but you know, when you get sober, you think you're going to get everything back, you know. But people kept telling me, don't expect that, you know. And we never got back. But she told me over the phone, she said, you son of a bitch, you're never going to get sober. Because I had promised her so many times that I was going to get sobered up, you know. So it was easy for her to say that, you know. And I took it. You know, I took it. And she's right. I mean, she's right about me not deserving a good forgiveness thing, you know. But I did put the ball in her hand and says, please forgive me. You know, and so, and I felt, man, I tell you what, I felt really good about that. I felt, uh-oh, man, this is a new lease on my life, you know. I did ask for forgiveness. Now when I get out of here, I'll be free to do what I want to do, you know. So the 7 months came about, and I went before the judge again. And before that, I had to give a speech to the group that was there, and I had to tell them how I was going to stay sober, you know. So I said, well, there's only one thing I could do that I know of. I says, it's the easiest way out for me, I think. I'm saying, well, at that time, I've only been sober 7 months, you know. I only knew one thing, you know. I'll stay sober one day at a time, I said. I told him. I says, I can't promise you guys I'll never drink, but I'll promise you guys that I'll stay sober one day at a time. And that's what I've been doing all these years, staying sober one day off at a time, you know. And so, and that's what happened when I began to get my recovery going, you know. And the good things about the recovery is that I had a new lease on life. you know. And I was told, he says, one of the guys that was took me to my first meeting, but I didn't I didn't stay sober. But when I went back to the meetings, I ran into him again. He says, Bo knows him, Bob C. He told me, he said, get a God box and put some goals in there, and I want you to work on them. He says, because you can, you got work to do to stay sober, you know. So I did. I put. I wanted to finish my college. I wanted to get my college degree. I wanted to go into business. I was an auto body and fender man, and I wanted to have my own shop. I wanted to travel, and maybe another wife. You know, that was a maybe. That wasn't for sure. At that point in time, I wasn't really sure. I had just got sober, you know. So, I can't think of the other one. But I got all of them. I've done all of those things. I did a lot of traveling. I've been to my friend, which is from high school. About 2 weeks after I got out of the inpatient program, he called me. He says, I hear you're sober now. He says, yeah. I says, yeah, I've been sober 7 months. I've been in the inpatient program. He says, I'm going to Mexico. You want to go? I says, how are we going? I says, well, we're going by plane. He's got a plane. You know, he's an airline pilot. That's what he was doing at that time. I said, yeah, let's go. So I get a bus and I go to Big Bear. That's where they had his plane in his place. That was 1980. Since then, because he's an airline pilot, I can get buddy pass tickets. They're really cheap, you know. So he was, I played football and he was my right guard. And so we, you know, we had a rapport of, you know, comradeship of people that I knew for a long time, you know. And so since then I've been to Italy twice, I've been to Spain once, I've been to South America, I've been to Mexico many times. That travel thing, you know, without even asking for it, came about. You know, I got into business for 5 years as an auto body and fender shop. You know, I completed my education. I got my AA degree. You know, I met my second wife. You know, and she 10 years ago she passed on because she got ALS, and there was there's no cure for ALS. But I had a great 20 years with her. You know. So all these good things that sometimes we don't talk about in a regular meeting, I like to, you know, mention that. So if a person gets sober, he knows that there is some good stuff out there that happens to people that quit drinking, you know. And so that's why I wanted to mention that. And I got inducted into the Livermore Hall of Fame for my work with others. I worked the 12-step and worked in the field. I became a counselor for 20 years, a bilingual counselor. I worked for Kingsview and I worked for Tulare County. I worked in the prison. Those good things, you know, happened to me because of one thing: Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed sober. You know, the fellowship has been really, really good for me. But I still got the same sponsor that I have. And I like to talk a little bit about my sponsor. It's because it's important for me to, how he helped me out a lot. I met him in the inpatient program. He was from my same hometown, and I knew of him, but I didn't know him personally. I had seen him in the bars. We drank together there, you know. But I walked in, and he was in there, and he had slipped. He had been sober for 10 years, and he had slipped. You know, so when you go into the inpatient program, right away, they assign you a buddy. So they, my counselor, she assigned him to me for 4 days. So for 4 days, I had to sit down. If I wanted to go to the bathroom, I had to ask him, hey, his name was John. John, can I go to the bathroom? He'd look at me and he'd laugh and says, maybe, you know. But, you know, I had to ask him for everything. Can I go get some water? I'd have to ask him, you know. When I go to the bathroom, I'd have to ask him. For 4 days, I had to do that, you know. And so, and then she said, you have to get a sponsor. I said, well, hell, what's a sponsor? I didn't know what a sponsor was. It's somebody that can help you stay sober. So I knew that he had 10 years, you know. So I asked him, hey, you're going to be my sponsor, man. Hell, I don't know anybody else. So you got to be my sponsor. So he said, okay, I'll be your sponsor. But see, he went in there as a volunteer, so he got out soon. Maybe 3 or 4 months after that, he got sober, felt real good, and he got out. And he said, well, I'm going to, and we had meetings there every Wednesday. He says, I'll come every Wednesday and talk to you. So he came about a couple of weeks, and then he quit coming. And then I heard he was out there drunk again, you know. So I said, well, I guess I'll still keep him. You know, I hadn't seen him, you know, because I was still in the inpatient program. I'll still keep him. So I got out, and I went looking for him. So I found him in the bar. And I said, hey, you're supposed to be my sponsor. What the hell are you doing in here? He says, he started quoting a bunch of AA stuff at me, you know. You know, and I said, gosh, man, what am I going to do, get another sponsor? He said, yeah, you better get another sponsor. So I said, no, I don't think so, because I'm going to have to start taking care of you now, because I don't want you out there drunk. For a year and a half, I followed him. You know, I didn't get another sponsor, you know. And the guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, who's your sponsor? He says, John's my sponsor. But John's drunk. What the hell? What? But you know what I got out of that? I seen what happens to a person that relapse. You know, and I never relapsed. Up to this day, I haven't relapsed. That's over 35 years, you know. And John is still my sponsor because he came back to the meetings, and now he has 33 years, plus his 10. So, you know, what did he tell me? He says, you can come back if you slip and go back. And I've seen what happens when you relapse. I mean, it's bad. And I didn't want no parts of that relapse thing. So that's how he helped me out there, you know. And so today he's still my sponsor. You know, I see him every so often, you know, in Lemoore, you know. But he gets a big kick out of that every time I remind him of that, you know. My drunk sponsor, you know. But anyway, my life has been great. You know, even though, you know, I lost my mother last year, I spent 3 years with her. I had to move back to Hanford to spend my last 3 years with her. She passed on. And then, you know, my dad passed 10 years ago. I had some of my best friends from high school pass. And, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship, you know, I've been able to maneuver through all these crises because of Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, the 12 steps and the people in it. Like when I was going through that, the diagnosis with my second wife, John and his wife would come and visit me, you know, my sponsor. He said, how you doing, man? He says, you don't want to drink, do you? He says, no, I don't want to drink, you know, because I was there taking care of her. You know, and so my life has been good. I've been able to get through these crises and not drink, you know, something that I don't want to do. And I know that people can relapse even for as much as time as I have. I know that. But I think that my program of just stay sober today and deal with what you got today. Forget the past. Forget the future. You don't know what the future is. The past you can't do nothing about but learn. You know, and that's been the big asset for me, is that one day at a time. You know, and I keep doing that. That's my, you know, some people say, oh, you're an old timer. I said, hell, I'm not an old timer. I've only been sober one day yesterday. You know, and so, but that's my own theory of how I'm going to stay sober. I find out that I have to stay sober for me, and if I can help somebody, I'll do it. You know, and if it'll help me to like I'm standing here, I'm helping myself because I'm hearing my own story, and I'm remembering all the stuff that I went through. You know, the 6 DUIs, the flights in the bars. You know, I had 2 guns pulled on me, and they were going to shoot me when I was in Venice. But that's because I was hanging out with the wrong crowd, a lot of drug people over there, you know, sometimes I rub people in the wrong way because I was kind of a, you know, rowdy myself, you know. And so it was, if they had pulled that trigger, I wouldn't have been here. Or those 5 car accidents I had along with the DUIs. You know, God has actually, when I talk about my drunk log, I know God was there. You know, just like He is right now standing next to me. You know, and He's saying, just keep going, my friend. You're doing okay. You know, and but yeah, you know, I do. I go to church. You know, I go to every Sunday, and I've got better. Like the book says, I've got better in my religion, and I'm growing more spiritually. My spiritual life is getting stronger. You know, and I don't know. There's not much I can complain about, you know. And I got a new girlfriend. She's sitting right there. We went to grammar school and high school together, you know. And it was kind of how we got together, as she was taking care of her mother and I was taking care of my mother. And we were texting back and forth, how you doing, how we doing. And it's just one of those things that just happened, you know. And I'm really happy about that because, you know, she's a real good person. And God put her in there for me. And so, you know, I'm pretty happy. I'm traveling that road of happy destiny right now. You know, and then as I go along this life, and I know I'm getting older. I'm 73 years old. I'm gonna be leaving this earth pretty soon, but that's okay because there's a lot of people up there waiting for me, you know. And I just keep coming back. I keep coming back to the meetings. That's one of the things that I'm never going to quit doing, is come go to a meeting. I go to a meeting at least twice a week. And that's the way it's been the last 10 years, you know, because I've had to deal with the death of my second wife and the death of my mother and my dad, and I just feel good when I come to a meeting and talk to people, you know. And now I'm able to talk to you guys. I hope if you get one thing out of what I said today, you know, take it home. Feel free and take it home. Yeah. You know, because I know when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, you know, after he got sober, we went to a lot of conventions together. And I always wanted to take, because he knew all about the conventions that we would go, you know. And I wanted everything. I wanted everything that speaker was talking about, you know. But later on I realized, I says, man, just find one thing. Says, that's all you need, is just one thing, and take it home, and that'll help you stay sober. And that's what I did. I just tried to listen for one thing that maybe might help me, you know. And so if I say one thing that'll help you, you know, I'll be happy about it. I hope you will too. But I just want to say that it's an honor for me to be here, and that's it. I hope I can.